Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The captain, you know, he went on the radio and he's like, we just want to make sure everyone knows he has a Paralympic champion on the plane.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their remarkable stories. On the Podium. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, I'm Joyce from the Philippines, and you are listening to The Happy Pod.
Hi, I'm Reese, and welcome to The Happy Pod.
Ciao, mi chiamo Mattia di Torino. Benvenuti a The Happy Pod.
This is The Happy Pod from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in this edition uploaded on Saturday, the 2nd of September, the extraordinary impact of an experimental stem cell treatment for a serious eye injury.
They kept talking about, thank you for participating and thank you for doing this for us. And I told them, thank you for doing this for me. They saved my life.
The Italian who saved a little girl as she fell from an apartment block.
I opened my arms, I closed the eyes and offered to catch her. I don't know how, but I did it. She fell on my chest, in my arms.
The green tech to help reduce the costs and carbon footprint of the fishing industry in Southeast Asia.
To have the possibility that you can give more to fisher folks out there, it's a very, very good feeling.
Also in this podcast,
the feet start moving, and the movement is 1, 2, 3 hop, 1, 2, 3 hop, 1 hop, 2 hop, and then there you go with the sticks.
Our political correspondent, like you've never heard him before. Many of us, perhaps, take our sight for granted. But for Phil Durst, who's 51 and from Alabama in the US, a life-changing accident left him blind and in terrible pain. Then he was given a ray of hope. He heard about an experimental procedure to treat corneas damaged by chemical burns and other such injuries. We'll hear about the science in a moment. First, though, Phil told us what happened to him.
So I was standing in front of a piece of commercial equipment in the back of a restaurant, and the pump built pressure somehow, and it squirted right across my face. It's 27% sodium hydroxide, landed pretty hard and heavy in my left eye and a little bit in my right eye. And I was blind and suffering some of the worst pain I've ever felt in my whole life.
And then you volunteered for this trial, for this experimental procedure. Volunteering for something experimental takes courage. What were your thought processes?
I couldn't go on doing what I was doing. I was suffering cluster headaches, migraine headaches, 1 to 2 a day. I couldn't leave the house. I was living in the dark. So the thought of like volunteering and being brave, I do not have a cape and boots in my closet. I would have done anything to make this stop. After the actual transplant, my light sensitivity has decreased. I actually started to see for a while there. It was super exciting to get to see the big A on the eye chart, you know, the biggest letter. And my distance vision in my right eye is 20/25 with glasses on. So I can drive a car. I can do all sorts of things. But talking about the quality of life and how life has gone on and how much better it is, I don't have words to describe it. I couldn't go on. It wasn't just being blind. It was what light did to me. I was walking around with my eyes closed everywhere I went because there wasn't a pair of sunglasses or shades that could filter the light enough to give me the relief that I needed. And this has. I mean, they kept talking about, thank you for participating and thank you for doing this for us. And I told them, thank you for doing this for me. If not for Dr. Yurkunis recognizing a need for something like this, what I was going through, I probably wouldn't be here today. And I mean, so Dr. Yurkunis, do you need me to cut your grass and clean your gutters? Give me a call. I'm on the next plane. Whatever you want, I will do it. She saved my life. They saved my life.
Well, let's hear now from Dr. Ula Yurkunis from Mass Eye and Ear in Boston, who's behind the new treatment.
This procedure is called CALIC. It's basically taking a small biopsy of a corneal tissue from a healthy eye, taking that biopsy, to laboratory to cultivate the cells or grow them, and after making more stem cells, placing them back onto the patient's eye.
So there's already another procedure using stem cells from a healthy eye on an injured one, but this is different, isn't it? You've improved the system, and this one is less risky.
Yes. Yeah, so currently in the United States, the most common modality is to actually take the biopsy and directly place it on the diseased eye without cultivating those stem cells. And a lot of times the risk of that is that you have to take pretty large biopsies from the healthy eye, putting the healthy eye at risk.
And what sorts of eye injury are we talking about? What sorts of people might this be able to help?
It helps various injuries, but it goes even beyond that. So if there is a patient who has an infection that has depleted their stem cells, if there is an issue of trauma to the eye or chemical injuries, so anything that can destroy those stem cells can be actually treated with this procedure.
So you've made the science clear, and it has been a really lengthy process to get this far. Tell us about the patients that you've been working with.
It is a really great pleasure and really honor to be able to do this trial because, first of all, the patients have entrusted their eye to us. This trial is a culmination of 20 years of work, literally from bench to bedside. So for me personally, it's wonderful that the basic research that we were working on is now in humans.
Dr. Ulla Yakunas, and before that we heard from Phil Durst. Now to Turin in Italy, which is celebrating an incredible catch. Mattia Aguzzi and his girlfriend Gloria were on their way to buy bread when they heard desperate cries from high above the street.
We heard somebody screaming from the balcony on the other side on the street. Stop, don't move, go back. Looking up, we saw a little girl at the fifth floor of the building next to us. We started shouting to her to stay back, but she didn't hear us. She continued until she was hanging just with her small hands to the balcony. In that moment, I was following her movements. I opened my arms, I closed the eyes, and hoped to catch her. I don't know how, but I did it. She fell on my chest, in my arms. It has been a strong impact. Both of us felt on the street. I couldn't breathe for a few moments. Then, after a while, she started crying. The worst was over. She was alive.
Gloria must be so proud of you.
Yes. She was very, very scared, not only for the baby, but also for me.
Well, yeah, it was a long fall, a huge catch. You did fall to the ground. Are you okay?
Yes, I'm okay. I've been at the hospital just for some checks Saturday afternoon, but after a few hours, I was at home. The strongest impact has been under an emotional point of view. The following night, I could sleep just a few hours. I started thinking more and more about what happened, or maybe more about what fortunately didn't happen. Mm-hmm. I felt like being in a parallel dimension. So many media were calling for interview to get information.
Including me, it must be said. Importantly,
yes.
The little girl, is she okay?
Yes, also the baby is fine. On Saturday afternoon, I saw her for a few minutes at the hospital. She was smiling, watching cartoons. This is the most important thing for me.
And you mentioned the reaction and all the media interest. Tell us a bit more about the things that you've heard from your family and your friends and social media and famous people.
When I meet my mom Saturday evening, she gave me a long hug crying for the emotion, as well as my dad and my sister. I received many messages from friends, colleagues, even from people who don't know. The Prime Minister, the Piedmont President. It is important to share the credit with Emilio, who was the first person to raise the alarm when he saw Frida on the balcony.
So, Mattia, you've had this huge emotional reaction from your family and friends and international interest. What's it like to be a hero?
No, I don't feel like a hero. I follow with my instinct. Hope that anybody else would have done the same. For me, in that fragment of second, it was the only right thing to do. I've always been a rational person, but now I'm starting to believe the destiny.
Mattia Aguzzi, hero. Traditional prosthetic limbs can be expensive and often heavy. And a lot of the places where they're most needed lack trained personnel and infrastructure. Well, one company trying to do something about that is called Koala. It started what proved to be a successful pilot scheme in Sierra Leone in 2021 and is now working to roll it out nationally. Founder Nate Makabuag told us what's different about his prosthetics.
The way we make prosthetics is much more akin to how you might make a trainer or a bit of sportswear or an item of clothing. So instead of a rigidly molded socket, it's soft, flexible, it's reinforced where it needs to be, but the rest of it is made out of fabric. And then instead of really complicated things on the end that are quite heavy and hard to use, we just have simple tools that clip on and off. You have ones for pens, for playing music, for doing other sports.
Obviously, you've been working in the UK, but you've also been carrying out a pilot project in Sierra Leone. What took you there?
Yeah, our chairman at the time had done work in the past and he had some contacts out there. And we met an amazing guy called Dr. Abs Dumboya. He was born with polio and then he saw what we were making and was like, guys, that would be so useful here. So what we kind of realized by making prosthetics like clothes is that you can put them in a box and send them to anywhere in the world.
Tell us a little bit about the sort of response that you have had from recipients.
They send videos of doing new sports, doing new hobbies, of trying new things or doing things I haven't done in years. And it's like, I wake up to these every day. It's like the most fulfilling thing I can imagine. So, I mean, the first time we actually went to Sierra Leone, which was 2021, we were only there for a week and we managed to fit about 20 people with upper limb loss, which is kind of unheard of.
How is that?
Very excellent. Excellent.
They were just happy to see that there were people paying attention. And for us, it was amazing because completely different culture. But actually what we saw was a lot of the similarities. A guy called Sullivan, yeah, the son, and his thing, he didn't need a prosthetic for most things, but what he says, when I'm walking my son to school, I can't hold his hand when I'm crossing the road and help him carry his school bag. And he'd send photos afterwards of like, oh, this is great, this is amazing. So the last thing we did was train the clinicians that make prosthetics in the country. There's only four, which there's about 25,000 amputees in the country. So it shows you the scale of the mismatch of the problem and the funding. So it's a model that if we get it right in Sierra Leone, can scale to literally anywhere on the planet. You can't describe that feeling of being even just a little bit useful to someone else. We work with approaching 1,000 people around the world. It's the coolest job ever.
That was Nate Makabuag from Koala. Now, some of the other things that caught our eye this week. The magnificent return of gymnast Simone Biles, who broke a 90-year record by winning her 8th all-round title at the US Gymnastics Championships. Her win came less than a month after the four-time Olympic champion returned to competition following a 2-year break. Her triumph took her ahead of Alfred Joachim, who claimed his 7th US title in 1933. Some good news for Atlantic puffins on remote islands off the coast of Maine in the US. They have had their second consecutive rebound year for fledging chicks after they suffered a catastrophic 2021. It's partly down to the abundance of a fish called the sand lance, allowing puffins to thrive. Now, you might have heard a report on the Global News podcast about some very eye-catching footage that emerged this week from Nebraska in the United States. Police there pulled over a man for driving on a motorway with a huge ball nestled in the passenger seat. Chad Ryman of Norfolk Police explains.
The officers received a call reference a car driving into town that had a cow in it. They thought that it was going to be, you know, like a calf, something smaller, something that actually fit inside the vehicle. There were some citable issues with that situation. The officer chose to write him a warning and ask him to take the animal back home.
The car actually had half its roof cut off in order to fit the animal and its magnificent horns in. You can see the footage on the US and Canada pages of our website, bbcnews.com. And a winner has been declared for Finland's ugliest vase. It's a thing, apparently. The winner against tough competition was a shiny gold vase decorated by a pair of fire red roses. Second was purple, decorated with golden ornaments and a sparkling plastic crystal. Third was an unusual combination of a copper pipe and black stiffened metal chain. If you want to look, and why wouldn't you, I will share using the hashtag TheHappyPod. Still to come in this podcast.
I felt like it's a whole new, like, learning and fun. It's like a whole new world.
What 11-year-old Reese thinks about the new Braille Lego.
Unexpected Elements is all about finding the surprising science angles to everyday news.
Mind absolutely blown.
Amazing to me.
That's Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, more of your sounds.
Hi there, this is Camilla Cooley from Sydney, Australia. I live next door to a school which at the 8:30, 8:45, 9 o'clock mark of a morning has a sound. It's like letting the children know that school's about to begin. And the sound is really quite jarring. It's just meh, meh, meh. It really not conducive to children starting out their day at school, and it's not particularly enjoyable for neighbours like myself. And very recently, I noticed that the sound had changed. And I imagine the reason the sound changed was to consider that we need to be more welcoming to children as they start their day. And to acknowledge that maybe for some groups more than others, a jarring sound can be really off-putting. So this is my sound that makes me happy, is the switch from the jarring emergency type alert sound to a really gentle, warm, welcoming, cheerful chime to set people on their day.
And Andrea from Rome sent us this. That's the sound of crickets when he works out on his bike in the empty Appia Antica Park. Thank you, Andrea and Camilla. Now, subsistence fishing is a huge industry employing hundreds of millions of people around the world, and it also has a huge carbon footprint. Now, a team of scientists is developing a solar power bank to help people in the Southeast Asian fishing industry reduce their impact on the environment, improve their own health, and save money. Geriza Molina from Shift Tech Marine in the Philippines told us about their project.
These small-time fisher folks usually go out at night, so they need the battery so that they can power the lights that they need. And what they use usually to power those lights are these heavy, bulky car batteries that are very, very dangerous, as well as they spend a lot on it, and then they can just use it for like a few months, and then they need to buy again. And well, after our fisher folks are not able to use them anymore, they just throw it away, so that's terrible for our environment. So we wanted to help these small-time fisher folks get the most out of their living and then make it safe for them so they can get home.
So that's the problem. What is the solution that you have come up with?
We created a safer and more convenient solar power bank. It works like the usual power bank, but it can be recharged via solar power. So when fisher folks go out into the sea, they can use the power bank to power their lights. And right now, it lasts around 18 hours. And then in the morning, they can use the solar charger to power their power bank. And then we are also working on the wind. So imagine you're in the ocean, it's very cloudy. We can use these wind power to charge our power bank. And it's really affordable. So our fisher folks spend around 26,000 pesos a year for their traditional battery, but we offer around 10,000 right now.
So what sort of impact is it having on the people who work in this industry and their families?
They're getting more fish out from the sea. That means they can get more income. It's really an amazing thing to hear about from them. You know, they share that they were able to go to the mall recently, and then to hear that their child has the goal of becoming a doctor, and then thinking that her parents can actually afford that now. And to be able to think that you already have this impact on such a small family, and then to have the possibility that you can give more to other fisher folks out there. And then there may be more children wanting to become a doctor, engineer, an attorney, and you can be a part of that dream. And it's a very, very good feeling that many people should strive for, yeah.
Geriza Molina of Shift Tech Marine. And you can hear Female Founders, Green Tech in the Blue Economy by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Lego has been a much-loved toy for more than 90 years, and it is still going strong. And after successful trials, the Danish firm has now released Braille bricks in English and French. The idea is to help blind children or people who have difficulty seeing learn to read letters and numbers by touch. Dr. Amit Patel, author and disability campaigner, told us what's different about the new Lego.
On a standard brick where you might have six little dots to connect other Lego pieces to, the Braille bricks correlate to the same as you would read out in Braille. So they would have one dot, three dots, four dots, five dots, but they also have lettering on the bottom actually printed to tell you what Braille they correspond to. So an A would be top left corner, and that's all you'd have. You'd just have one tiny little dot. So it's very much to help someone who wants to learn Braille to be able to put them out and actually feel the dots as opposed to try and feel the little dots on a piece of paper.
Does it still work to build things the way that the original Lego does?
It does. And that's the beauty of it. It's still compatible with your original Lego that you might have lying around or that you play with at home. But the beauty of this is you kind of learn Braille as you go along. So I've got two young kids who are both into Lego. They're both sighted. They want to learn Braille because they watch their dad, but it gets to a point where they're just bored. So I found that with Lego Braille bricks, we can sit down and we can play, but they're actually learning as they go along. So in our household, it's a win-win.
How important is it for kids who have impaired vision that manufacturers are paying attention to the sorts of toys and learning devices that they can use and have fun with?
Lego, for me, is one of those universal games or toys that you can interact with despite having sight loss. And you can play it with everybody in the household. So I think manufacturers need to take notes on when they're producing games, making games, to make sure that they're inclusive and there's a way of being able to play with them with everybody else.
What is the most impressive thing you've ever made from Lego?
When I was a child, it used to be cities and towns. But now with my kids, it's more dinosaurs, monsters, anything that's big and that you can destroy within a second.
11-year-old Reese has severe visual impairment and he's been trying out the Braille Lego.
So you can play whilst you're still learning, and it teaches other kids, like my little sister that's three, she understands it's Lego, you build stuff with it. But I've taught her that she, with Lego Braille bricks, she can lay them out and make different words. I felt like it's a whole new learning and fun. It's like a whole new world.
So you've been trying out this stuff. What sorts of things have you been making?
I have been writing a lot of sentences, and I made everyone's name, and I have been using them as normal Legos sometimes. You can build cars, houses, a lot of different things.
So if you had to give it stars out of five, Reese, what would your verdict be?
If I could go higher, I'd say like 20, but 5.
And Amanda, Reese's mum, he obviously is really enjoying it. What's it like for you as his mum watching him learn this new thing?
To be honest, all different kinds of emotions. I always obviously feel the pride seeing Reese doing all the different things when it comes to Braille, but it's lovely to see that he's not only learning, he is playing at the same time. And as he's doing that, he's pointing it out to his sisters and they're picking it up along the way. So it makes you really happy.
Reese and his mum, Amanda. Now, time for another sound. This one, though, came to us not from a listener, but from our very own political correspondent, Rob Watson. Now, Rob has been making sense of the twists and turns of UK politics for a global audience for many many years on the BBC World Service, and while on holiday, he was reminded of our historical signature theme tune.
It used to be the tune that would say, aha, I am listening to the BBC World Service, wherever you were in the world. That da 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 da. It was, if you like, the BBC World Service's signature tune.
This obviously was not on the BBC World Service. This was not that particular rendition. Tell us about this particular piece of music.
Well, it was an extraordinary moment. So I was on my holidays in South Devon on the south coast of England, and I came out of the pub where I was having, of course, the traditional fish and chips, and an extraordinary sight greeted me. So it was a troupe of Morris dancers, and for those of you who've never seen it, it's a tradition that dates back to the mid-15th century. It's people dressed in white, they've got bells and handkerchiefs, and they're doing this dances. But it wasn't just the dancers. I was like, hang on a minute, I know that tune. And it wasn't instantly recognisable, but they could, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and people Morris dancing to it. I mean, it was just an extraordinary sight. And I could just feel myself light up inside. You know, when you get one of those good feelings, I could feel myself sort of smiling and thinking, wow, I haven't heard this for a while.
Now, obviously, we normally talk to you about British politics. People might not realise that you have a cultural hinterland, as it were. You yourself do have an interest in Morris, don't you?
Oh my goodness, Jackie, you've brought it up. I once danced, I think you were there, you were recording, I once did a bit of Morris dancing in the BBC newsroom. Everyone must have thought I was mad. I do. So, as I mentioned, it's a tradition that goes back to the mid-15th century. It sort of went out of fashion in the 19th century as Britain industrialised. But then in places like Oxfordshire, where I grew up as a boy, it was revived. And so amazingly, in the 1960s and 70s, if you were at a sort of humble state primary school that I was at for people under 11, you learned how to Morris dance. And it was one of the best bits of school. Every time I hear that music on May Day in Oxford or a place like South Devon, the feet start moving. And the movement is 1-2-3-hop, 1-2-3-hop, 1-hop, 2-hop. And then there you go with the stick. So, you know, I can feel my feet moving.
There really is no end to his talents. That's the BBC Morris Dancing correspondent, Rob Watson. And that's it from us for now. Remember, if you would like to be part of the Happy Pod, you can email us the sound that brings you joy. We would also love to hear if you have any stories to share that will make us all smile. As ever, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Alana Bowles. The producers were Anna Murphy and Tracy Gordon. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.